So welcome to that webinar on group awareness. We have Dr. Jeroen Janssen with us today. Let me quickly introduce him. Jeroen Janssen is focusing in his research on the study of interaction and interdependence in learning situations. And his research topics there include cooperative learning and collaborative learning. Some of you might be interested in the difference between that, also especially computer-supported collaborative learning. This is where I know Jeroen very well from. He's focusing in his work on peer assessment and on scaffolding. And in his research, he uses different methodologies, which I find also very interesting, and maybe we can also speak a little bit about that today. So in his study or investigation on interdependence and interaction in a collaboration situation, he uses quantitative content analysis. He also uses multi-level analysis, social relations models, and so-called actor-partner independence models. Of course, this would be, for some of us, very interesting to learn more about it. Career-wise, he was a PhD student for a couple of years, from 2004. Finalized his PhD in 2008 at Utrecht University, and the title of his PhD thesis is already quite related to this topic, using visualizations to support collaboration and coordination during computer-supported collaborative learning. And since then, since 2008 until present, he's an assistant professor and he's conducting research at Utrecht University, and he's also supervising PhD thesis, so he might also be willing to share some of his experiences how to conduct a PhD study on this topic. Okay, I think that's everything I wanted to tell about Jeroen. The rest now is up to Jeroen. There are a couple of slides, and maybe I try to share that again. It has been shared already. This is there it is, twice even. So those of you who did not download it, please download it from there. You will need it, and Jeroen will lead us or guide us from slide to slide during his presentation, and maybe he mentions the slide number a couple of times so that people know where they are. Still one more thing that I forgot. You have a couple of most of our speakers afterwards said, well, they were surprised that people liked that session because they had no feedback at all. Of course, there is some feedback in discussions, but you have a couple of possibilities also, like these smileys, or also under the vote tab, there is even more smileys like these or these. And you can also type things into the chat. I think it is good for the speaker if you just from time to time give some life sign so that you're still following, or if you have questions, just press the join broadcast, join the queue or start broadcasting button. Okay? Okay, now Jeroen, it's up. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Frank, for the wonderful introduction. For me, it's the first time that I will do this, so I try to pay attention to Frank's directions in how to organize this webinar. For you on the slides, I've given on slide 2 and 3 my aims for this session, because I hope that this will be an interactive session. So I hope you will ask me lots of questions. And also during the during my slides, you will see several questions that I want to share with you. I want to discuss with you about. So this is I hope this will be an interactive session. Anyway, so I want to talk to you about group awareness tools, coordination, because I think that's an important process that happens when students work together in groups. And I heard from several of you that their research interest is on cooperative learning, collaborative learning, group work. So I want to talk about coordination as well, and especially in computer-supported collaborative learning environments. If you look at the third slide, where I've listed the overview of today, I have three topics that I want to talk about with you, and I'm of course open to any other suggestions for topics that we could discuss. So I want to tell something about the origins of group awareness, of the research on group awareness. I want to share some of the research findings, which were also presented in the paper that you probably that you might have read for today. And I want to talk about methodological and research issues, because as you maybe noticed from Frank's introduction, one of my professional interests is in research methodology and ways to analyze data from these kinds of learning situations. And I think there's a lot of room for discussion there. So I want to talk to you about that as well. But first, I'll go to the fourth slide, because I want to tell you a little bit personal about me, where the interest for this research came from. During my study, I studied in Nijmegen, that's also in the Netherlands. I became interested in cooperative learning, and I did a master thesis on how students, primary school students, could be trained to use elaborative help giving during cooperative learning. And there my interest in, you know, group work, cooperative learning, collaborative learning was sparked. And for that master thesis, I had to visit like 40 different classrooms in the Netherlands and observe all kinds of students working together in groups. And I noticed that many of them had difficulties with that. In some cases, the collaboration was wonderful, but in other cases, it was not. And there, an interest sparked. I wanted to know more about that. So in 2004, I got the opportunity to go to Utrecht, here in the center of the Netherlands, to do my PhD. And I did a PhD on, like Frank said, computer-supported collaborative learning. And the starting point for that PhD, which I shared with my supervisor, Gijsbert Erkens, was that CSCL is a promising learning strategy, something that we could really use in education. And we know that also from research, you know, several studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of CSCL and collaborative learning in general. But many things can and do go wrong, and that's actually one of the titles of one of the chapters in my PhD thesis. So if you look to the fifth slide of my presentation, I've listed some of the things that we noticed about group work here in the Netherlands. So for instance, if we observe groups that they sometimes have conflicts which are sometimes mild, but sometimes also really hostile conflicts. So that's something that we noticed. Another problem that we noticed was free riding behavior. We all know the free rider, the person who lets the other group members do the largest share of the work. That's another problem that we noticed. Also, of course, when we look at interaction between students, we want to see them discuss things with each other, to exchange arguments, to give feedback and give elaborate help. And in many cases, we noticed that the quality of these discussions were, well, disappointing to say the least. Especially if we looked at computer mediated communication, we also noticed communication problems, that students often had difficulty understanding each other, and so on. And the last thing that we noticed were coordination problems, and I already mentioned that that's one of the things that I really find interesting. So coordination, I will talk a little bit more about that later on, but basically it's all the things that you have to do when working together which are not really directly related to the task that you have to do. So things like making plans or keeping track of what the other is doing, stuff like that, that's coordination. And we noticed that students had difficulty with that. So the starting point from my interest in awareness, in collaborative learning, were these problems. If you look further on in the slides, I will talk a little bit about one of the first solutions that we proposed. But first, now I have a question for you. You can see that on the sixth slide. I hope that you want to discuss and share with me, maybe from your own experience or from things that you've noticed in classrooms with students or whatever, the problems that students, and I would like to add also teachers, encounter during collaborative learning and maybe computer supported collaborative learning specifically. So maybe you could take a short while amongst yourselves to think about that and maybe share that with us. And thank you, Frank, for sharing the question with the audience. 4 minutes is fine, Frank.
Sorry to interrupt. Would it make sense to ask just people to tell what the local results of their reflection and the discussion was? Would that make sense to have a quick round so that we have this impression?
Yeah, I agree, Frank. I think I would like to ask the other groups to join the queue, and if they want, and to share with us what they discussed on this question.
So our group was mainly talking about the unequal participation, and we've been discussing on like classic computer supported collaborative learning environments where two or more people are sitting in front of a computer, actually like we do here, and there's one person in front of the keyboard and the mouse, and he somehow can dominate all of the others because he's the one who's going to type in something, or in my case say something.
Yeah, or move the mouse.
Or move the mouse or anything. But we also talked about the domination, well, in a group when someone is more talkative and he can like rule the group, and some others who want to participate can't even participate because he's overruling them all the time. And then we had another question.
Yeah, I posted a question because it's about the group dynamic before you start an activity, like for a group awareness or the computer-supported collaborative learning activity. And is what about, for instance, the role of personality and the role within the classroom before the activity starts? Because, for instance, these people that overrule or these people that don't talk that might have interesting ideas, maybe they don't do it because of their personality. Maybe they are too shy. Or maybe the role before the activity starts, like you have, for instance, the nerdy person, and then you have the bully, and then the nerdy doesn't share anything because the bully will just start bullying him. So you also have a dynamic that is before. So how can you? Okay.
We'll stop.
I guess I should stop. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I'm all alone in the room, so that's a quick communication. I had some experiences with asynchronous communication, so less with synchronous. It's quite some time ago, so 6-7 years ago, we connected different students during their placements at different institutions. And they had to discuss basic science and knowledge connected to the experiences they had in practice. And the main problems we had there was we focused on deepening the discussion with a certain method. We had success with that, but the problem was the availability of the different participants over time. So some people hadn't time to attend for a few days, and then the topic of the discussion already was past what they addressed earlier. So they felt that they missed the front end of the discussion. So this timing point was a problem, And the suggestion then was to make some synchronous moments online as well, sort of beeper moments as in the hospital. And another thing was that there were a lot of interesting things coming by that couldn't be addressed because there was a certain focus in the discussion, and all these bits and pieces were quite interesting but weren't addressed later on, and how to also involve these interesting, not expected topics later on was a problem.
Hi, this is Julia. I'm sorry we didn't introduce ourselves before, so we had some technical problems. And I'm here in one seminar group, and we discussed also mostly asynchronous communication via computers. And I think what we said is that there can be a lot of misunderstandings because nonverbal cues are missing, and I think that's one of the most important things.
Face-to-face communication is missing too.
Because usually also there's face-to-face communication missing, because you usually have written communication, and this can cause several problems. Also that it's usually not, or quite often not clear who did what, if there's a problem people should work on. And if someone contributes something, it's not clear if someone else did the same and just didn't say it, or someone else did nothing. And I think these were the most important problems we identified.
Thanks, Adam, you too. So as our speaker has left currently, I think for some important reasons, my suggestion would be to collect further contributions now. I will try to summarize that once he's back. So what I put in the chat that was a bit above was that one thing that really struck me over and over again when I use computer-supported collaborative learning, or when I try to use computer-supported collaborative learning in my own classrooms, that is that even if you are really convinced that this is a good idea and that you would like to contribute, you tend to forget that over the week because there are so many other things that squeeze into your daily life. And so in the end, the very least thing that you can do or are able to do very late is a tiny contribution to some online collaboration. And I think this is for me, this is one of the biggest problems you can observe that over and over again in quite different scenarios.
Hello, this is LMU 2. We didn't introduce ourselves either, so we're students of master education, and we don't have any experience with a webinar like this, and that's why our question is, how do the teacher deal with no experience computer supported collaborative learning by the students, and that's it.
Perhaps Frank, you want to answer on that, because I don't know how long our expert will be missing, and you know quite a lot about collaborative learning, and
we
it
already,
might be your turn.
We already have collected like 5 questions with all the speakers.
If it were so easy, then we wouldn't invite these experts. I think what would make sense is even to wait a couple of minutes, and maybe the other ones, Ulrike, Michael and others, can also contribute their views so that we are in good shape once our speaker is back. I hope he will be able to come back. Let me say basically my short answer as a researcher on collaboration scripts would be that many of these things need more structure, and one approach is to develop scripts that can help to overcome this problematic. But group awareness is a contrasting view. So it's the opposite, more or less, as a perspective. It's the perspective that it's enough to give people the appropriate means to provide them with information on how they are doing it, cognitive or social information, in order to self-regulate their behavior. And I think this is in a very sharp contrast, and research is still waiting for combinations of these. And today, I think, therefore, I'm happy that we have Jeroen here. He's a representative of the perspective, like others as well, of the perspective that most of the time it's not necessary to give people directives what to do, how to behave, what activity should be performed next, and instead give them information on how they perform, how they do it, and then a process of self-regulation might start of a group, and but also of an individual. I think that's my very, very basic answer to this. So if you ask me for my answer personally, I would suggest to put more structure and a little bit more of directives as well. But the perspective on group awareness is coming from a different direction. The question is, are you referring to not using scaffolding? Well, I'm referring to that group awareness researchers often recommend not using collaboration scripts that that provide you with the roles and suggestions what step should be next. I think we can discuss if this isn't scaffolding, because this is information that helps you to perform on a higher level. So performance is leading competence. You are better able to perform than your actual competence is indicating, or is would be spontaneously able to guide you through that process. So in that sense, well, would be interesting. What Jeroen says is group awareness also a form of scaffolding.
Yes, just to use the silence, I can imagine that also the context makes a difference. That if you use collaborative learning on a distance, you have these problems. But if you use it in combination with a face-to-face meeting, so it is more an artificial way to make processes more explicit, you don't have a problem, because you're all sharing the same room, and you can motivate each other, and you are sure that everybody is in you need.
So, Jeroen, I'm not sure. So I'm sorry to hear about distressing phone calls. I hope that it straightens out soon, or even has been straightening out. So can the question is, can we go on? I could quickly summarize the state of our discussion. Could you tell us, Jeroen?
Yeah, sorry guys, I had to take this phone call. It was a kind of distressing call I didn't expect. Of course, I missed most of your discussion, but of course, I really want to continue. So maybe, Frank, if you can summarize a little bit what was said, then maybe I can react to it.
Okay, maybe the others just help me with that recollection. So I think the one question that came up at LMU by Carlos Mauricio was this dominance aspect, if this isn't related to some personality traits like shyness, and having nerdy and bully persons in the classroom, and if this hasn't shouldn't be considered as well. Another question was, what do teachers do when students do not have any experience with computer-supported collaborative learning? So what is it maybe necessary to qualify people before they can work on computer-supported collaborative learning? And maybe if we go back, there was one thing when I tried to answer some of the questions, because LMU tried to force me into that. So there was one question remaining of that. I more or less described the two contrasting perspectives of scripting, which is one answer to the problem of unequal interaction and so on, and the awareness perspective that is more giving information on social and cognitive aspects in the group to people in order for them to self-regulate. And then we ended with the question, if scripting is of course a form of scaffolding, is group awareness and group awareness tools especially, can they also be considered as a kind of scaffolds, but more non-directive scaffolds? And may I ask the others to add to these questions if I forgot something important?
Okay, thank you, Frank, for the summary. I think you asked interesting questions. First, maybe let me say something about the question about scripting versus awareness, which I agree is two different approaches to supporting students. One more directive, whereas the other is more giving information and giving students their own leaving students the freedom to act on this information. We debated this quite heavily in the beginning when we started with this research, whether we should take a more directive approach when supporting students, maybe more resembling scripting, in the sense that you can in CSCL environments easily collect information about students' behavior and maybe asking them to respond in a certain way. But we thought, well, we were actually quite keen on the other option, on leaving more of the responsibility to act on information that you receive from an awareness tool to the students, because I think scaffolding is also about transfer of responsibility. Of course, it's about supporting students, but it's also about transferring of responsibility from the teacher to the student. So I think one of the final goals that we want to reach with collaborative learning is that students are in the end able to decide for themselves how to, you know, approach a big project that they usually have to do when they work on a group task. So I think one of the goals is, of course, indeed that we want them to learn how to self-regulate, and I think that's why we chose more the awareness approach instead of the script approach, which is the script approach, which has also, of course, been very effective in terms of trying to get students to interact in a certain way, and which has also been found to affect student achievement and group performance. So we deliberately chose a different strategy there. I think the question is still open whether one option is better than the other. I think they can both coexist, actually. I hope I've answered that question, or at least I've offered my opinion there. One of the questions was about dominance in the group and whether personality could play a role in that. Yes, I think so. If you think about, for instance, extroverted students versus introverted students, I could imagine that the introverted students might feel more inhibited to participate, and the extroverted students might dominate more the discussion. So I think individual characteristics always play a role here, and personality could be a factor there. I think for awareness tools, I think one of the mechanism that awareness tools stimulate is giving information, giving feedback. So I think with these kinds of tools we could help students to, you know, to maybe change their behavior a little, the dominant students to become less dominant and the less active students to become more active. Last, you asked about the role of the teacher. Yeah, I think the role of the teacher actually is quite understudied in this area. Right now I'm supervising a PhD student and she's investigating how we could support teachers in computer-supported collaborative learning environments. And actually there's not a lot of research there. There was some research by Christa Asterham, for instance, on how to support teachers, but we don't know a lot about that. So we don't really know what kind of competences teachers need when working with this type of education. And we also have very little information about what kind of support teachers would need, because if you think about teachers monitoring discussion forums on the internet, or teachers monitoring students' chat discussions, and sometimes of up to 5 or 6 groups at the same time, you can imagine that that's really a big a big puzzle for teachers that they need to solve in order to be able to guide these groups effectively. On the other hand, some studies, I think about studies by Noreen Webb and by Robin Gillies, have shown that the teacher really plays is kind of a role model for students, in the sense that a behavior that's displayed in the class by teachers is often copied by students. So if the teacher interacts with students in a certain way, then students will see that as a model and try to copy that behavior. So we know that the role of the teacher is important, but we actually know very little about, okay, why do certain teachers have a certain way of guiding groups, and why do other teachers do it in a different way? We don't know how to support them very well. So I think there's really a line of research that still can be addressed. Yeah, I see Bas has a question related to that. I think there's also something for group awareness or information that we use in group awareness tools that could be interesting for teachers as well, and to help them to monitor what's going on within the groups. Do you have any other questions, or do you want me to continue right now? I will give the floor to Frank.
I just wanted to suggest, before going into depth with Bas' question, maybe go ahead a bit, because I think we have a couple of students who never saw a group awareness tool. So they, and even after reading your paper, they will still not have a clear visual image of a group awareness tool. So maybe it would be good to move ahead.
I agree, Frank. Of course, because of copyright questions, we could not in the article include screenshots of the tools. But if you look at the 7th slide, I talk about one of the solutions that we proposed in my PhD research on addressing these problems that we shared and that I mentioned in one of my previous slides. So one of the problems that we found most that we observed most often was the unequal participation problem, and we asked ourselves the problem, the question: can we use visualizations to help address these kinds of problems? And I've mentioned several reasons on the 7th slide. So with visualizations, you can give complex information in a easy and handy format to students. You can give them feedback: what's happening, what are you doing, how much is everyone participating, for instance. And you can also help them to facilitate coordination. So at the beginning, I mentioned coordination as one of the as one of the processes that students are involved with and when collaborating, and often they are not really aware of that they are coordinating their activities. And one of the things that they have to do, we write about it in the paper as well, is that they have to coordinate their collaboration. And one of the aspects that they have to coordinate is, of course, the participation of each group member, because usually a teacher would like input of all group members. And also input of all group members is actually important for the group, because you can benefit from the input. And also we thought that visualization could motivate students. So we went ahead and tried to design a visualization that could help to address this participation problem. And if you look at the 8th slide, you see a larger picture of the tool that we developed. We called it the participation tool, and it's actually quite simple. You see all the students from one class there. They have their names. You can see them a little bit. It's a bit vague maybe, but you can see that each group member has a circle or a sphere, and the size of the sphere represents the participation level of the student. So we just counted in the environment that they worked in. It was a computer-supported collaborative learning environment, how many messages they sent to their group members, and we visualized that. And we the size of the sphere increased when the student was more active in the chat discussions that they held. And in the visualization, you can already see that some groups, some students have larger circles than other students. So that's an indication that these students are more active than the other group members. And in some groups, you see it's actually quite nicely divided among the three or four group members. So we saw this tool as a way of visualizing information about participation levels, and that's something that's sometimes difficult to really infer from a chat discussion, who's the most active participant. And we gave feedback in a quantitative manner about these participation levels. And then we conducted a study with this tool, and you can find the results on the 9th slide. And we conducted a sort of quasi-experiment in several Dutch classrooms, where some of the groups had access to this visualization, and the other groups didn't. And one of the things that we were a bit afraid of that would happen was that students would try to manipulate the visualization. So that they would start typing nonsense comments in the chat just to increase the size of their circle. And at the beginning they did. So they were starting to type all kinds of nonsense messages to increase their circles. But then they quickly were corrected by their group members. So they were giving the student the indication that they noticed what... they were gambling the system. That's right, Frank. They were giving the group member who was gambling the system the indication that they noticed it. So when we looked closer at the chat discussions, we noticed that they were using the information provided by the visualization to coordinate their collaboration, especially the coordination in what we call the relational space of collaboration. So the relational space has to do with all the things that have to do with communicating effectively, and also all the things that have to do with the functioning of the group. So they really used the information that was provided by the tool to discuss with each other, okay, how do we proceed with this group? How do we have to collaborate? And when we looked at the levels of participation in a quantitative matter again, so how many words did they write and so on, we saw that the levels of participation became more balanced, more equals in the groups that had access to this tool. On the other hand, we were a bit disappointed when we found out that when we looked at the quality of the group performance and the individual achievement, that we found no effects of this tool. So we found that a tool like this could affect their behavior a little bit, so the participation became more equal, and that they used this information to discuss the collaboration amongst themselves, but in the end it didn't lead to better group performance or individual achievement. Boss has a question. Can you explain the distance from the center as an indication of the group input? Yeah, good question, Boss. I didn't explain that. So the size of the circle is indicated by, I have to say this correctly, the total amount of keystrokes, I guess it was, in the chat tool. And the distance from the center represents the total number of messages that was sent by the specific group member. So both are an indication of participation. They are somewhat correlated. So usually you see that someone who's closer to the center of the group is also has the largest circle. I hope that explains your question, Bas. So for now I hope you have an idea about this visualization. The quality of the participation is not weighed in the graph. Indeed, we didn't look at the quality of the participation. For that we would have needed to analyze the messages. And that's really a really difficult thing to do. So it's really only quantitative information about participation. And when we talk to students that work with this visualization, they also mentioned that they saw a discrepancy there, a difference between quantitative and qualitative information. They said, well, okay, my circle is actually quite small, but if you look at the things that I wrote in the chat, they were really helpful, really contributed to the group, and this is not really acknowledged in the visualization. And that's indeed true. It's just a quantitative measure of participation. If you don't have any questions right now, then I would like to go to slide 10 and 11, because when we started doing this research, we found there were several theoretical concepts that were relevant to this research. Let me see. So for instance, the distinction between the content and the relational space. I already talked about the relational space. The definition is also listed there. And group awareness tools have also been developed for the content space of collaboration. So the content space of collaboration is aimed at working on the task, on cognitive activities. And other people in other research groups have developed group awareness tools for that aspect as well. Maybe we'll talk a bit later about that. And when finding out more about collaborative learning, the functioning of visualizations and group awareness tools, we also, like I said, became more interested in coordination. Actually, the quotation there on the 10th slide is one of the things, one of the quotations that I really like about this process, because you can see that as a necessary overhead. It's something that you have to do when you're working together with multiple students in a group. And I think group awareness tools can play a role in facilitating coordination. On the 11th slide, I talk about group awareness tools, and this is also information from the paper that you might have read. So what is group awareness actually? When we started this research, our starting points were the visualizations, and only later we came across the concept of group awareness, which is actually something, a concept that wasn't in collaborative learning research that much, but was more investigated in computer-supported collaborative work. CSCW, as they call it. And there they one of the interests there in that area of research was on providing information about, for instance, who is online. So if you look at the flash meeting environment, the screenshots, the small pictures of all the participants are examples of awareness information, because I can see your pictures, I know you are online and you are listening to me, or at least you can listen to me. But I think we thought, well, this concept is also relevant for CSCL, but not so much on the presence level, on who is present and what is everyone doing, but more on these two important things that students have to do. So activities in the content space and activities in the relational space. So we took this concept of group awareness, and I wasn't the only one, other people did this as well. And we thought, well, okay, you can also think about awareness in terms of cognitive group awareness and social group awareness. So cognitive group awareness is, okay, what do the other group members know? What is the other group member working on? What is his or her knowledge? What is his or her opinion? These kinds of information you also need to collaborate effectively. Social group awareness has to do with the relational space, and it has to do with the social situation of the group, who is doing what, who is participating, and so on. And in both cases, the awareness information provided by these tools can be used to help students coordinate the activities in both spaces. Okay, let me see. So if you we analyzed for the paper that you read some of the group awareness tools that were developed, and there are some interesting issues there that we can talk about with respect to these tools. For instance, which information should be provided? Of course, it depends on the kind of awareness that you want to raise, but it is an important decision to make. Also, for instance, how is the information gathered and provided? Is the system that collects the data, or do we have students provide information? And if you look at the 13th slide, you see there sort of spider web. And I think Frank will recognize it because he was in the PhD committee supervising this thesis by Chris Felix, also from Utrecht. Here you see an example of a group awareness tool. Chris calls it the Group Radar, which is a tool that doesn't collect data automatically, but uses the input of students. So on regular intervals, students rate their group members on the dimensions that you see here, quality of group work, influence, friendliness, and so on. And this information is then fed back to the group members. And also this is social awareness information that is provided by the students, provided by the system, and can be used by the students to, you know, to talk about. I think that's the most important thing, to discuss with each other how the group is functioning and whether changes should be made to the quality or to the way the group is collaborating. I'm going to skip a couple of slides. I want to go to the 15th slide, and then I have a question, because I think I've been talking quite long now. Because in the paper, we also describe a conceptual model, in the sense that we make a distinction between the two types of group awareness. And of course, cognitive group awareness is usually used to coordinate activities in the content space. But we also notice that in some cases, cognitive group awareness was also used to coordinate activities in the relational space. For instance, some cognitive group awareness tools also had an effect on the quality of interaction, on the levels of participation. And then the other way around, if we looked at some of the social group awareness tools, we also found sometimes that they affected coordination in the relational space. In the end, the coordination and the activities in both spaces affects the effectiveness of collaboration, as we found. And then I have a question for you, question two on the slides, number 16. I hope that you have time still to discuss with each other the strengths and weaknesses of group awareness tools. What do you think are the strengths and what do you think are the weaknesses? And maybe you could take again 5 minutes to discuss this within the group and maybe share that with me and with the others. Yeah, and if you're alone, you can reflect or discuss with the monitor of your PC. Maybe you could also reflect on the spider web, the radar tool that I showed on the number is missing on the, I guess it's the 13th slide. What do you think such tool, which uses the input of the students on maybe sometimes things that you don't want to share with your group members, what do you think that might pose any problems or has any specific weaknesses or strengths? The radar is not it's somewhat anonymous in the sense that you see aggregated scores that your group members give you. It cannot be traced back to the individual students that gave the rating, but it's the aggregated scores are visible for everyone in the group. So it's if someone is receiving low scores on these dimensions in the radar, then you see then it's visible for everyone. And I agree, it's cluttered, and this is only from one group, so you only see your own group. So these are the group members in one group of four students, I guess. So can be cluttered. Yeah. So maybe there's someone who wants to share with us the strengths and weaknesses of these kinds of tools, and I'm going to share a link with you of of a paper that's available online where you can see an example of a cognitive awareness tool. You can just, if you follow the link, you can see on one of the pages an example of a cognitive awareness tool where students rate each other's contributions, the quality of the contributions. So that provides information about what group members think of your contribution, maybe the quality of your contribution. Maybe Bas, could you explain your questions? I think you have some interesting questions.
So why don't we ask the different participants and groups to just speak up in the video chat and then also ask the question again, maybe.
Okay, so our group was discussing whether group awareness tools might make a group aware of some point, but the group like is not really interested in being aware or just knowing that they're like on the bad side of the contentual space, and they just want to discuss something else, and that the group awareness tool gives like less feedback or less
the feedback is not important for them, I will say.
Yeah, or the feedback is not important, or
yeah.
Yeah. And that was one question. The second question was whether
Another question is like, if you want to use group awareness tools, don't we still end up trying to somehow regulate the environment in a way that their group awareness perspective would say, okay, you don't need to tell students what to do. But then at the end of the day, if they are straying from what they are supposed to discuss, the tool would still tell them to come back onto the particular thing that is being discussed. So what are the major and clear differences between this particular prompt and then a normal prompt that would be used in a scripted environment?
So we discussed a little bit, first we didn't really understand how this works and how we can collect the data to get this view, and we thought it would be some kind of automatical, and then we understood what you said, how it worked, that people rate other people, and then we were a little shocked because we couldn't understand or imagine that this would be really helpful, and that for example, there's one person in pink which is not rated as very friendly and very productive and very helpful, and we thought if this could rather lead to reactions and to the person doing nothing anymore instead of helping the group adjust or get more productive. So maybe the question is always what type of information you collect and how people can react to that.
I want to react to your question or your remark. I think I think you stress an important point there. So what happens if we just give this feedback to students, especially if it's shocking, if you're rated as unfriendly and low quality of work? On the other hand, I would say that my experience thus far is that often students have these kinds of opinions about their group members, but they are often not shared. And I think that's also, it could be a problem if someone is perceived as not productive, and if it's really the case that he or she is not productive, that's of course a problem for the group. Groups often shy away from discussing these kinds of things with each other, and this could be a first way of discussing this among the group. Of course, it will lead to heated discussions if students differ in their opinions on these things. But I think often they really shy away from these discussions. I think that's really a pity, because I think really if they coordinate their collaboration effectively, they also discuss these kinds of things. Although, yes, sometimes it can become, especially in this radar view, can become quite personal, and sometimes, it could be distressing to the particular student.
Well, Bas, no, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, there was something technically wrong. Just commenting on this polar graph, perhaps I understand it wrong because I missed the explanation. Do I have to read that every colored line, so blue, pink, is the response of one of your peers on one person? So this is a collection of the opinions of a group on your performance? Or is every color a different participant scored? So as a summation of all the opinions of others?
If you look at the lines, it's for each student, there are four students in the group, it's the average of the ratings on the six dimensions, six it is, that they received. So it's the average of the other group members of how they perceive that specific group member. Does that answer your question, Bas?
Yes, it does. because if then you are compared with your group mates, how you perform on these different aspects compared with others. But I can also imagine that you don't want this comparison, that you are very interested in how your group mates estimate your value in this group, and that you want to see the aggregated information only for yourself. So then you don't get the strengthening effect that if everybody is collaboratively thinking your performance is poor, you get this very overt on the screen. And if you don't know from these others that others find this same thing, you are not publicly punished. So would that be not a better solution?
I think that there's still lots of work that we can do on researching this, on what kind of configuration is better. I think, on the other hand, the ability to compare yourself to the rest of the group, it could also be positive, because if you only have the information about yourself, then you then it's difficult to know where you're standing. For instance, maybe I receive a score of 2 on friendliness in this radar, and if I only have that information, then I could think, well, okay, they really don't like me, they don't think that I'm not friendly. But if I can compare it to the rest of the group, then I know better what the value or the meaning of this particular average is. If I can compare it to the rest of my group, maybe everyone is perceived as unfriendly, or maybe a score of 2 isn't even that bad altogether. So I think the comparison could also be beneficial here. I think that's also why we put that in the participation tool that I showed you before, that students can compare themselves to the rest of the group to know where they are standing with respect to, in that case, participation.
Yes, I can understand, but if you want this comparison, you can show your performance compared with the mean of the others. And what I would be interested in how the diversity of the opinions is of my peers. So if every line in the polar would be the response of one of my peers, so I could see, okay, there is some different opinions, and I understand how the group feeling is. So that is filling in the information in a different way.
Okay, maybe Jeroen, if you want to answer to that, to Bas' remark. There's also by Anuak Valero, you notice retaliations. I think all of these comments are targeted towards the reflector, where people rate others. And I think from my perspective, and this is because I was also asked which are strengths and weaknesses of group awareness tools, and I think one of the real strengths of these tools is that they can work with simple, more or less physical measures, like the mere sound that is produced or something, and can use that to give groups some feedback. I think it will still need a bit of time until these tools can automatically track the quality of the discussions and so on. But I think there is already a big success of these tools, also on a very, very basic level. And my question to you, Jeroen, and also to others, would be, So where do you think are the limits of these very, very basic indicators of interaction? I just wanted to share one link. Maybe you would have showed that anyway, Jeroen, but maybe some of you are now transported to a website, so please make sure to find your way back. But this is something that Pierre Dillenburg did in Lausanne, and some of you might even know this. This is a table where there are microphones that just record the noise that are produced, and there are a couple of microphones, and the more lamps are lit, the more the person sitting behind these lamps have been talking. And I think this is a really fascinating, very simple mechanism to show that someone is dominating. So, and this is one comment I would like to make. The other comment I would like to make is, if you look at this table and also look at what Jeroen showed us before, my question also would be, what if people cannot handle this information in a way? So if they lack the self-regulatory skills to use that information and to change the group situation? Well, two questions, or maybe also comments.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Thanks for sharing the mirror table developed by Pierre Dillenburg and his colleagues. Yeah, that's a really interesting approach that they take physical, in this case, audio cues, and just feed it back to the students. I think that's like you said, is one of the strengths of this mechanism, in the sense that if we think of good indicators, and that's also the difficulty of good indicators of valuable information that we could feed back then to the students, I think there's a promise of these kinds of tools. So the pitfall is, or the difficulty is, to think about these good indicators, because as you noticed with our discussion, the little discussion we had about the participation tools, you know, with the circles, it's always, most of these things have to do with quantity. So we visualize the quantity of chatting in a CSCL environment, or we visualize the amount of noise or the speaking time in these tables, but that's an indication of quantity of participation, of interaction. So I think one of the challenges is to think about all these indicators that are meaningful, and of course we should also think about and maybe that ties to your second question, try to think about how we can learn students to deal with this information, because so the first reaction that I noticed in my research was that students try to gamble the system, and I can imagine that will also happen with the tables that you showed in the link. So we have to teach or talk or whatever with them on what to do with this kind of information, and also to point out that it's important that they have sensible discussions about this. My main point is that I see coordination as an important activity, but seldom students do it by themselves if we don't prompt them. So I think these tools have an opportunity to prompt students to do so, but we also should help them to use this information effectively. And of course, there might be reasons to disregard the information that we provide them. In some cases, they might notice, if you look at the table, for instance, the picture on the website, there's one student there with the yellow circles. He seems to be talking less than the other speakers, but okay, maybe if they talk about this, they find, well, okay, his contribution was still very valuable. So I think one of the challenges for this line of research is, you know, to think about these indicators that we use in these kinds of tools, and which kinds of indicators are valuable there. Okay, did I answer your questions, Frank? Okay. How much more time do I have, Frank?
Well, yes, I think we're more or less done with the time. If I think it would be, from my perspective, it would be good to have maybe one more a little glimpse into the methodology area, because some of the students might be interested in also including some group mirrors and group awareness tools in their own research. So if we could jump to this, if that makes sense to you, Jeroen, and then maybe have a little wrap-up session. So if we go for another 10 minutes, I think then we should be, well, more or less done.
Okay. I agree. Maybe we can go then to slide 20, where if we look at the research that's done now, the published research, we see that it's usually experimental, quasi-experimental research with a pre and a post-test, but these studies are quite small, and most of them do quantitative analysis, which is maybe surprising if you think about the state and the phase of research in on group awareness, because usually if you think about from a more design-based research perspective, then maybe a quantitative study wouldn't be the first kind of studies that you would do. But most of the authors adopted quantitative analysis, and the dependent measures, they focus on performance, so what is learned, and how well do the groups perform, and also focus on the collaborative process. So what happens when we give them these tools, what happens with the collaborative process? And then we see that people, I did that myself as well, that they really look at the discussions, and they code these discussions with a coding scheme, and then compare, you know, different experimental and control groups to see are there any differences in the group activities, in the collaborative activities. And also we see questionnaires that are used. And I'm still wondering, and that's my last question, the fourth question that I had on slide 21. With this in mind, the kind of research that is now done, so quasi-experimental, comparing a condition where you give an awareness tool to a condition where you don't give the awareness tool, small scale quantitative analysis that focus on performance and the collaborative process, do you see other opportunities for research on group awareness tools? And I think there are interesting avenues that we could still explore, thinking about new research designs, for instance, and different dependent variables. So now we focused on performance and on collaborative process, but there might be other dependent variables that are also important to take into account, like motivation, self-regulatory competence. Does that increase if we provide students with awareness tools? And maybe are there other factors, other theoretical concepts that we haven't addressed in this line of CSEL research, but other concepts that are also important? For instance, in my talk today, I used the concept of feedback a couple of times, but the whole theory of feedback isn't really incorporated in research on awareness tools. So that might also be a caveat, a theoretical caveat of this line of research. Yeah, I was wondering, that's why it was my last question, whether you see any opportunities. Maybe we could take a minute and then you could share it, and otherwise I can offer some of my ideas there. So from what you heard, do you see any opportunities for new research or things that should be done differently?
Jeroen, I just wanted to suggest, because in the last webinar I was sitting together with a group, and I noticed that these groups are always under time pressure. So maybe if we give them really a couple of minutes, like 2 or 3 minutes for discussion among them, and then ask them to just raise their hand and speak up. That would be my suggestion.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Frank.
Like,
Okay, oh. We're broadcasting
okay.
now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're thinking about is that we could learn from tools that exist in the written text, analyzing written text. So you don't just analyze the fact that a student said something, but then you look at what they said, and then the whether the words that they are using are relevant to the particular learning context and the particular learning content. So adding some form of content analysis to all these procedures would be able to make much use of these tools and make them more accurate at saying who is making the best argument or who is really contributing to what has to be done.
May I add something? Yeah, we were also thinking about maybe these techniques of content analysis might be mixed with other kind of analysis as you have done before, you have shown us today, and for instance make a ponderation of the data based on, for instance, the amount of words produced versus the amount of like accurate words measured with the content analysis tool, and then you will have like ratios that are like people that talk very few but make good arguments, or the opposite, people that talk a lot but is really not interesting or not related. So we were like discussing about that.
I think that those are two really interesting suggestions on incorporating ways to analyze the content of the messages by students instead of just the amount of participation. I think that's really a good suggestion. I think there are some people working on that. We did a small scale study there for my PhD on something like that, but still we have there the difficulty of okay, one, what kind of content analysis do we do, and can we do it automatically, and can we do and can it then be meaningfully? So it's again the question of okay, what are the indicators there that we could feedback to the students? Maybe we could think about domain specific concepts that students use. You know, define beforehand which concepts are relevant for a certain task, and then feed it back, mathematical concepts or whatever what the domain of the learning task at hand is. And I also really like the suggestion of combining the quantitative information with the qualitative information. I think that's that could be a fruitful avenue to pursue, to combine, you know, the amount of words with also information about the quality. So we have a combination of quantity and quality. Are there any other groups that want to talk? Yeah, I agree that this is also very difficult technically, that we still have difficulty analyzing spoken but also written text, natural written text, to give awareness information. And that's also why sometimes in certain cases we use peer feedback or peer assessment or, you know, rating of contributions by other group members to in these kinds of awareness tools. But then we have other problems with, like the ones we discuss, is it fair, is it shocking, and so on.
Yeah, we discussed again about the question of being rated, and we thought maybe it would be interesting to conduct more in-depth research, probably qualitative, or discussing with people what kind of information does what to people. So for example, if you can have more objective data, how helpful someone is and how nice, does this lead to different reactions than being rated by others? So looking more into the details of the group awareness tools, we thought this might be very interesting.
Yeah. I agree. I think these kinds of tools, especially if we use peer feedback, peer assessment, we know very little of how students. So in this radar that I showed you, they have to give a rating to a student, and we don't really know how they've used their perceptions, their observations to give this final rating. So that's one thing that we don't know. And the other thing is, indeed, we still have very little information about the effects of these kinds of ratings. And are these peer ratings, are they more effective, or are they more threatening or whatever for students compared to more objective information? So I really agree that we should do more research on that. One of the things that we did with the data that we got from Chris Felix's research with the radar is that you can also look at, because we had lots of groups completing the radar, that you can also look at, if these students rate each other, do we see that the variance in the ratings that are given, can that be attributed to the student who is actually being rated? Or is it more attributed to the student who's giving the ratings? So if peer assessment is objective, then you would say, well, I want that most of the variance can be ascribed, be attributed to the one who's giving the ratings. But actually what we found in lots in Chris's research, that for several of these dimensions that you see in the radar, that most of the variance could be attributed to the one who's giving the ratings. So what that means is that students, when they use these kinds of tools, these peer assessment tools, these group awareness tools, that they use their own biases, their own conceptions when giving these ratings more than really objective information about the one who's being rated. So that's really a challenge for these kinds of group awareness tools. And that ties in with the introduction of Frank, who said that I was interested in methodological issues in CSCL, and to analyze these kinds of data on peer assessment, on students rating each other, you need a social relations model, and that's one of the things that we are investigating now. So, okay, if you look at these peer assessments, can we attribute the variance to different sources? So the one who's giving the rating, the one who's being rated, and maybe also the relationship between those two. So the one who's giving the rating and the student who's being rated, they have a relationship, and does that affect the rating that is given? So that's one of the questions that we are looking into now. Now I'm looking at the chats. Yeah, I think emotions could also be, and that's a good suggestion as well. Emotions is one thing that we haven't really looked at. Some researchers have, but what are your emotions? What's your affective state when you that you're in when working together and using these visualizations, these awareness tools? Yeah, we haven't really looked at that, and I think in light of the discussions that we have about that these things can be threatening, I think that would be a good dependent variable that we could also investigate. Think aloud is also a good way to evaluate this. Actually, we are doing this now with teachers. We are giving now teachers these awareness tools, awareness information about, for instance, participation level of students that they have to that they have in the class, and then we're asking them to think aloud what they perceive and what their their thoughts are when they see these awareness information, and why they choose certain actions then based on this information. So I think, and well, we already found some interesting things in how teachers use these tools, and which information is more relevant or easier to interpret for teachers. So I think that's a good methodology to think aloud. Yes, time consuming, but good. Frank, I'm going to give the floor to you.
Yeah, I think time's more or less up. I would like to thank you, especially Jeroen, but also all the participants for discussing today and presenting. I think what I'm still thinking about one thing. In many instances, you have research on technology-enhanced learning, computer-supported collaborative learning, and other forms of instructional approaches. And oftentimes you can say, well, history repeats itself and now it's this technology. And I'm struggling with this sentence with respect to group awareness tools. I think there was nothing like that in the past. So this is really a new phenomenon that is investigated now, really new. So there were no group mirrors when this technology was not existing. At least that was my impression. Thank you very much also for persisting today, given the obvious disturbances you experienced by others via another kind of technology. I think we really learned a lot about different tools that can be used, but also some of the strengths and weaknesses currently. And I think together we also worked on different lines of research that might follow from there. Jeroen, may I ask you one question? Because we ask all our speakers one or two more meta questions. I'm not sure to what extent our audience today is aware of how such a paper is finally appearing in such a journal. Could you give us a quick overview on how that worked? So was that you submitting your ideas to that journal and then it was just published, or how was that process like, and how did this paper change in the process?
Okay, good question, Frank. That's one of the things that obviously you learn when you're a PhD, and then the publishing aspect. I have to say, very good promoters, very prominent promoters in the field of CSCL. So that's Gijsbert Erkens and Paul Kirchner, who are both, Paul is a really productive scholar and editor of several journals. And Paul is also a very good connector. So he connects all kinds of people that he knows. And he also is also always on the lookout for opportunities to work together and to seek an outlet for that. So Paul had the idea that there should be a special issue in this journal, and he proposed it to the editor, Clark Chin, and then he was looking for people who could contribute to this special issue. So he asked Sanna Jervola, for instance, to write a contribution, and he looked for all kinds of people, and because he knew me, of course, he was my promoter. He asked me, could you write something about group awareness? Because this is a very journal with a very high quality standard, it was a difficult process to write this paper. The timeline was very strict. The guidelines for how long the paper should be were very strict. And I really struggled together with Daniel Bodemer to write a coherent paper. It was also especially difficult because we wanted to give an overview in a relatively new area of research. So at first it was a more technical paper in the sense that what's now lacking in the paper, we gave overviews of several awareness tools that had been investigated that far. But the editor and the reviewer of the journals really wanted a more meta perspective on group awareness. So they wanted an overview of the research, and they wanted it to lead to a kind of conceptual model. What is the purpose and the effects of these kinds of tools for CSCL? So in two rounds of reviews, we wrote and rewrote the paper, and then it was finally accepted. But it was one of the most difficult papers I ever wrote. It was different from what I wrote before, which were more standard research studies that were published. So this was difficult. I had great help from Daniel there, who's also very active in this field of awareness, and also was helped a lot by the reviewers, because that's one of the nice things of submitting your work to a high quality journal, is that you get really good reviews. Of course, you are sometimes a bit disheartened by all the criticism that you receive, but in the end, what you write, the product that you come up with, is always better because of the feedback of the reviewer. So one of the things that I really learned here is to value the criticism of the reviewers and really to take it seriously. And I think it led to a better paper there. So it was published at the beginning of this year. It was a difficult process, but also a really rewarding process, because now I think we have a special issue in this journal, which gives a really nice up-to-date overview of different areas of research on CSCL, and I'm really proud to be part of such a special issue. Does that answer your question, Frank?
Yes, thank you completely. Jeroen, I think maybe we have a quick round where every remaining participant or the groups could say how they feel now or what they take away from that session, to give you also kind of awareness information or feedback information. And then maybe you have the final two or three words, and then we close that session. Thanks everyone for participating. Well, you need a script, maybe. Michael, would you start, and then Anwag, and then the LMUs, Ulrike Franke, that in that sequence, would that work?
So thanks for this interesting discussion. For my work as a teacher, it's very interesting to see that there are some tools and quantitative measures about awareness, group awareness tools. So I take that with me. Thanks.
Well, from my point of view, I found the topic very interesting, and in addition of group awareness, also the feedback, the combination of both could lead to potentially good results, and is something that I will consider for my research. Thank you for the talk.
Thank you very much for the very interesting webinar. I for myself can say that this webinar about group awareness made me aware of group awareness. And I didn't spend too much time on that topic until now, but it's really, really interesting. I think many different kinds of group awareness tools could be very beneficial in different settings, like at school, at university, and it's definitely worth making more research in that area. So thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Yeah, from our group, thanks to Jeroen and all the other participants, we did get a good insight in group awareness, either by interrupting. maybe we can discuss in our workshop with Julia those problems of group awareness more further. So yeah, thanks.
So here's the second seminar. Thank you very much. I think it was really interesting and a very good start for starting new discussions. And I think my group over here is also interested in discussing more, but I think they are also exhausted because it was lots of new insights today. Thank you.
Okay, I will take the floor lastly then. Well, it was very nice that you all participated, despite the obvious problems that I had at the beginning of the webinar. I'm really glad that you stayed along and tried to participate. For me, it was, like I said, the first time to do a webinar like this, and it was really interesting to see how all kinds of different students and researchers have different opinions and ideas about this topic, and I really learned a lot from it. Also, I'm a bit jealous of the people in Munich with so many PhD students and students interested in CSCL. I wish it was the same here in Utrecht. But who knows, maybe we can think of things that CSCL will also become a more prominent research area here in Utrecht again. But I would like to thank you for your attention, for persisting with me, and I wish you all the best in your studies and the research that you are going to conduct. And I hope to see you face to face sometime somewhere on a conference or whatever. So for all of you, have a good evening, I guess, and who knows when I'll see you again. Thank you. Bye from Utrecht.